Of Ruth Ellen Coker's newest collection of poems, One Girl Babylon, Al Young says, "Unpredictable in voice and tone, these tender, tough poems narrate, educate, commemorate, celebrate, and vibrate." This versatile poet also takes on as many subjects as she does voices and tones, from race to religion, from art with a capital A to raising an adoptive daughter. And the best of these poems touch on many such themes in one poem, finding that right tone between confessing and consoling, humor and horror. One of my favorite poems in the book, Interstate 81, begins, "The projects were a gift to us, the meek who inherit the earth, walls for our roaches, foundations for our rats." Here, as in so much of her work, Ruth Ellen Coker voices first the world's pain and then hers in that order, which is what makes them ring clear and true. As Al Young again says, "This versatile poet blinks at nothing under the stars, and I might add, under the sun or in the dark." Her work is both elegant and unflinching. Ruth Ellen Coker is also the author of Desdemona's Fire, winner of the Naomi Long Magid Poetry Award. Both One Girl Babylon and her second collection, When the Moon Knows You're Wandering, received the Green Rose Prize for Poetry. She studied at Penn State University and at Arizona State University, where she received an MFA in creative writing and a PhD in American literature. Her work has appeared in numerous journals, including Washington Square Journal, Plowshares, Crab Orchard Review, the Missouri Review, African American Review, and the Gettysburg Review, as well as on the St. Louis Bus and Metrolink system as part of the Arts in Transit project. For the last few years, she has been working on a literary monograph entitled Janus-Faced Women, Multiplicity in Modern to Contemporary Women Writers. She currently teaches at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Please welcome again to this podium, Ruth Ellen Coker.
Okay, how is that? At 1 o'clock today, I had no voice at all. So I stopped talking at 3 and was hoping that it would come back. So I hope it stays until the end. I have an extra lozenge right here. I'm going to I'll read a little bit from One Girl Babylon, and then I too am going to read some new work, just as Greg did. I have this little form that I've been working on, and the newest project is always the newest obsession, and it's hard to let go of. But my friend and student Ken Harrison bid me to start off with what he called a crowd pleaser. I know, it's funny to think of in poetry, like people lighting lighters. And so I'm going to start with this poem, one of the few poems that I've written that is mostly all true, because I'd rather lie in poems, called Ode to the Woman Who, On the Day I Earned a Doctorate, Mistook Me as a Shoe Clerk, which is true. I want to tell you, I loved how your shoes sparkled like the muted gold flecked into an East Coast diner's creamy Formica countertop. I want to tell you how I imagined them on my wide feet, yellow and crusted with the desert of 5 years, walks to the library, to my truck, to the bar, to my classroom, to my office, the copy machine always down, and to the bar again. And yes, I imagine the thin slips of leather emerging from beneath the plum-colored robe that would embarrass and thrill me as I walked the procession, gowned over my round shoulders. I would sit in just 4 hours through long speeches by deans I had never known, but who were happy to tally another retention with a handshake. I could have forgotten the head cap of my mortarboard, too small to crown thick African twists damp with pomade and beeswax. I could have forgotten your tap on my shoulder at just the moment I was remembering mangoes hanging heavy on a sparse tree near the top of Saba Island. So close to the cliff, the sea longed to swallow one whole. But I didn't. I did not tell you that you were mistaken, or that my husband's skin rose into goose flesh at my touch that morning, even after 10 years of waking to the same black mole on my shoulder. I kept from you the moment a month before I had cradled a student in my arms because the year had mugged her and left her bruised. And so you couldn't know that the smell of dust from rotting volumes of Gertrude Stein replaced the stench of toilets my teenage hands scrubbed in other people's homes because government programs for us kids at risk risked us. I did not tell you because you were right in noticing every brown face in that store name-tagged, your beautiful feet pedicured into acceptance. I want to tell you now never to read this poem aloud in your home as Esperanza, your maid, listens at the sink. Never read it, because the words will sift through your ears and fall into the forgotten spaces between your ribs. They will rattle in your gut. They will circle the chasms within your shins and fall to the hollow of each smooth foot just near the arch, lost to any hope of hearing. And Esperanza does not need to hear them, not from your lips, because she can still take her own name home at night, lotion her knees, peel an orange into the distance measured between the two doorways of her apartment, and love the sharp scent. Love how it becomes her life, like the words of this poem, and how, for a few hours, the citrus oil hanging in the air washes you away. Poor lady. She had no idea how much she pissed me off. And I'll follow that with another ode called Ode to Missing Black Girls. You girls, twisted into summer with your new clean braids, yellow ribbons, and good humor sticks still tacky in your palms, you are lost. You who are not named Elizabeth or Jenny or Sarah, and if you are, you are not straight A students or daughters of senators, and if you are, you are not Mormon or blonde or part of a youth group. And if you are, you do not sleep in a bed covered by a duvet that matches the drapes. And if you do, it is not a big bed. And if it is, it is not a big house. And if it is, it is not in the right neighborhood, not newsworthy alongside of the local school board meeting, not new enough news to change your fate. And if it is, it is still not important enough for anyone to know. Richard ordered that up for us. I wrote this next poem after reading a review. Those of you who write and have published, it's so interesting to me to read reviews and discover things about my poems that I love the interpretations. So I wrote this poem called Issues Involving Interpretation. The word has no life of its own, despite what the writer tells you. Behind the sword is no quivering hand worn into life's hilt, no arm swaying the wind in dying movement. There is only the word, sword. Outside, the trees live without language and tip toward whatever sun manages through a thinning atmosphere of dust, ice, and vapor. The life of each branch balances on what the tree affords it. The soil holds the tree without language or pity. But there is no tree in this poem, only the word tree. There is no speaker who entreats you to imagine the tree standing solitary in a green field, specked with clover rising up in tufts of almost transparent cream. There is no field. There is no clover. No green. But you listen anyway. Hear her voice follow you into the afternoon. Imagine language crosses a clearing, the stark way a thing reveals when thinned clouds expose better light. You are the tree, tipped toward words as they overcome absence, bring outward your inner forms. Gabriel in the kitchen slicing onions. I always have these figures popping up in my house. Oh, the angel of death is in the kitchen, or Shakespeare is watching TV. Milton is in the shower. Gabriel in the kitchen. For an angel of death, his fingers lumber roughly over hard surfaces as though earth and gravity rob the very nature of grace away from him. The knife is sharp, I say, hoping he can slow down, feel his task unfold like a great building of something new. He stares at the food, unable to speak. Cucumber, tomatoes, zucchini, radishes, each thrown over his shoulder in a haste of disregard, a service to the perfection of Genesis. These are God's vegetables, I tell him. They are as perfect as the first day when sky wrung out the atmosphere in sheets of light that became sheets of air, water. Earth pushes them through its crumbling skin as though each labor renews our faith. Gabriel ignores me, takes up the task of crying. The onion skins fall around him in thin sheaths powdered by the heel of his sandal, the scrape of his robe. With each slice, I imagine his retort, that gardens are splayed memories of all we've lost, beds of hubris ripening, delusions of creation as though we believe the act itself of reaping gives us strength. The knife falls hard with each cut, allowing the butcher block to echo back heart's rhythm, a metronome swing, a clock's pendulum wound down to its final movements. When I shift to see how the onions streak his face, he turns away. The window holds him speechless. Lilies crawl around the edge of the yard, corkscrew through leaves like green blades guarding them. They trumpet striped orange profiles as July passes, bow as the sun retreats, call insects into their scent. Even to this spectacle, the mouthpiece of God remains silent. Okay, time for the Geigens. I came back from a very wonderful conference where I saw a lot of people who I love and adore in June, and I wanted to just start a project that was new, that kind of let all of this stuff drop away. And so I started working on developing this 16-line form. And the way the form appears on the page in these poems is that there's a couplet, a triplet, couplet, 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 triplet, and a couplet line 1 repeats as line 11, line 6 repeats as line 12, and the last couplet is a volta, which turns away. And you don't need to know that, but I'd love to say all of that. And as I was getting to the heart of this form and trying to figure it out, I was, I was up late. It was 2 or 3 in the morning, and I was, as usual, watching either bad movies or infomercials. And one of my favorite movies came on, Godzilla versus Gigan. And Gigan, he's the best Godzilla monster because he's just a monster they made up of all the pieces of the old monsters, because it was one of the last movies and they didn't have any money, so he has like 2 pincers for his hands, and he's got this ultraviolet ray cyclops eye, and the best part is he's got a bandsaw in his stomach that goes around and around. He's got 3 fins on his back. So I call this form the Gigan, actually. And I love that movie. So I have this little clutch of Gigans that I've written. And they are numbered as opposed to titled. 3. And let me also just say that I turned 40 this summer, and I found that all of a sudden the poems all became about fruit and sex and death. And not necessarily in that order, but sometimes all at the same time. 3. I would give up Anjou pears for you and their cousins, the Bosque, which are more beautiful, wrapped ochre, wrapped gold around their small deaths, wrapped securely as though they know an old friend will call, say love, say no. And this old friend, he would die for a crust of earth peeled back to reveal some buried bliss, a dance of bees singing out the ruined pleasure of their battle, their lavish avenues of forsythia, their swank arias of roses, inked roses, sung roses that want most to be the silkworm slink and cower. Pity them, their faithless world, their bruised and darkening red. I would give up Anjou pears for you. I would peel away their splendorous backs to reveal the equation we build our hunger upon, the dank musk of decay turned sweet, the soil's woe-begotten centuries mulched into pollen, nectar. Think of the silkworm's desire. It dreams of mulberry leaf, its singular drive toward the green silhouette of rapture. 9. You imagine you are made of glass. The thought does not depart from your daily life. Your wisteria out of season, the dim dogwood shedding berries, your chipped failing walkway to a front door that is not yours. At night, you settle into an opaque fullness. The inside of you belongs to you. In the morning, the light, always there, turns out your silent recesses, strips you bare, a flirtation of refraction and transparency. You imagine you are made of glass. At night, again, you understand the invisible, fill yourself with blindness and stars. Open your mouth to the silver vowel the moon would make if it spoke just once, if its reflection could estimate sound. 12. The fat dancers in the swimming pool have learned anything in water is beautiful, and so in unison swell their unlikely movement, spin through atmosphere that imagines them the lightest of masses. Look at their suspended stomachs bob and sway. The huge breasts find water's slow orbit as lap currents would ripple a crane staked to her own inevitable lift and soar. They are not unlike her. white skull caps, arms spread wide as the crane who wings landscape into a passing canvas. The fat dancers look at their suspended stomachs, see a worth expand and float. They gleam in the pool's sharp light, reflect the burden of their slick presence. But the crane most understands the lumber of gravity, the way a body rises in spite of itself. Fifteen is kind of a special one because I got an email from Kenneth when we were working together last term, and he said he had a dream that I was singing hymns in a church. So I immediately stole it and wrote this poem before he had a chance to. So. He dreamt last night I sang a languid hymn in a church glazed with shimmering epiphanies. I wore a satin robe stained by hive-colored light, cast through the glass cross above, a windowed liturgy. And there, that poor boy king, tacked down in vespers, seemed to vibrate the pitch of each exaltation, my throat opening in that divine swarm of service and need. In this dream, he reached to touch the pallid face of him, to pass his hand over the broken ribs, finger the gashed spleen, as if from blood rose some reflex of red's bright apology. He'll dream again I sing the martyr's hymn, the pitch of his dying, my throat's exultation, the weight of his knees, the taste of that crying, my mouth's consolation. Yes, the taste of him. Imagine, buttered light transfigured, coiled against each scapula bent in prayer, sweet as a honey buzz of voices summoning a cohort of wings, humming their wild grief. Last night, my chest opened like a house, swinging the front doors back on their hinges. The night found its way inside, curled into a backdrop for the heart which beat a strange and tangled rhythm. The ribs stood rigidly futile, scaffolding my failures, my muscles, my tendons, my arteries and veins. And when the doors flew open, no herd of wildebeests sprinted forward. No black mamba slithered. No zebras darted from behind my lungs. No giraffes sauntered out. No meerkats, no mongoose, cheetahs, or gazelle fleeing them. I felt my chest open on a hinge of night. Inside, I found muscle and tendons, arteries and veins. What was there avowed what I am no more than what I am not. Do you hear the heart's struggle to beat again? Do you hear the savannah's grasses rattling the wind like a cage, the sound of those beasts grazing each pace of their feral plain? I have just three more for you, and then you will be set free. 8. As for the earth in the thick of summer, it forgets its song. The ground grows deeper every day. The sun seeks out its furthest reaches while ants, single file, consume each word we say. What of my face do you imagine keeping? Not even your eyes can resist a memory's damp seduction, some radiant lust that vines the season you remember. How long ago, green carpeting, knees rubbed raw, light filtered into pink squares patterned on the boarding room ceiling. My shoulder and then my knee, your steeled breath. The yellow lawn confirms the earth's forgotten song, some radiant longing that raises every vein. First, your temple throbbing year after year, then the forehead, its blue pulsed release of some quieted need. Oh, but the earth's surrender to the sun's seared conviction. Oh, but the scorched grass, the relentless and prying heat. Listen to the flock of grackles praising the just softening fig, the disturbed hush brushed back by their wings, the placid spiral of their hovered beaks bleeding out a black gravity, say the tree, say the fig's altar, say the mute sugar invoking its seed, dark skin purpled from green, say, a woman whose eyes close against their clawed and feathered descent, a brutal harvesting, a hewn heart, the frictive branches craggy in their upward reach. Say, here is a bird, an animal that receives a feathered happening, listens to the flocked emergence in its throat, imagined by a woman whose brown eyes bloom inward, like the fig's implosive ripening, or assumption billowed in a velvet robe. Here is her mouth that opens like a fig. Listen to its plum valediction confessed to be yours. And one more. 21. The first time I tried to ride a horse, I screeched in fear as my cousin lifted me toward her back. The horse, in turn, spooked and ran away without me. Her black eyes turned in their sockets, watched me fall into the leafy background as she retreated. The moment came and went again. I saw her run away. I imagined her filled with glass eyes that bobbed against her sides as she ran, all of them looking backward in my direction. The beige grasses flattened with her ears, swayed with her liquid mane. My cousin held my waist tightly in his chafed hands, my legs bent upward, ready for stirrups, to ride the horse against my fear and then to watch her run away. I saw her run away. I saw her look wildly into my eyes and see the slow revolution of my youth begin to spin faster and faster, see my moon-faced revelation that I was a burden. I was a burden, and her back, with its velvet spirals of hair, could not hold me. Thanks.